to the south.
That segues right into the beginning of Parsha Shmini. Essentially, this is the end of the training process, of the chinuch process, of the Mishkan and of the Kohanim, and preparing us for the actual usage of the Mishkan, which will come after. So it's a brief aliyah, but there's a lot of complicated kachim to figure out. If you want to see more about it, we won't get into so much detail as much as we otherwise could, perhaps, about some of these psukim. But, for example, as is often the case, the Sefer Chabotelos HaSharal, a nice contemporary Sefer on Chumash, where he often focuses on some of the more detailed aspects of the parsha, so especially when it's kachim related, so he has a lot to say. And if you want to delve into those topics a little more, I would tell you to take a look over there. But we'll say a little bit and try to get an overview of this psukim, and then maybe say a few words about Shabbos HaGadol. So here the Aliyah begins with Pasuk Lamed, Parches Pasuk Lamed. Vayikach Moshe Mishemen HaMishcha Umen Hadam Hashor Mizbeach. So he took from the oil, he took from the blood that was on the Mizbeach. Vayaz Al Aron Al Begadav Al Banav Al Bigdevonav Yito. And he sprinkled it on Aaron and on his clothes and on his sons and his grandchildren, and who were, I'm sorry, the garments of his sons that were with him. And he sanctified Aaron and his clothes and his sons' clothes. So here we see the dam that is part of the sprinkling process, Neshama HaMishcha. The dam of the para, which is presumably also necessary here, so that's the whole technical discussion when that was available, if that only was prepared on the second day of Nisan. One place where there's a long discussion about that, if you look at those Nayim Latorah of Rav Zalman Sorotskin, he has a lot of discussion about where exactly that fits into this whole picture. But just move to the next pasuk. It says, "Vayomer Moshe al Aaron v'Yalbanav Boshlu Asavaser Pesach Avamoyes." And Moshe says to Aaron and to his sons that they should boil the meat, to cook the meat in the front of the door of the Avamoyed. Visham tochluoso, and that's where you'll eat it. Yes, alecha masher b'sal hamiluim, and also the bread that's in the basket of the miluim. Kasher tziveisi leimor Aaron uvanav yochlu, as I have commanded, saying that Aaron and his son should eat it. This word tziveisi, if you look at Yaakov Kamenetsky, has a comment here. It's a little bit of an argument how exactly it should be punctuated. We have it as tziveisi. And what exactly this connotes, Rasham Shemuel Hirsch understands that it emphasizes the idea that Moshe is saying that I transmitted this commandment, and that Moshe, who is now serving as the Kohen, because during these 7 days he was the one doing the Avodah, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. So he's telling the sons of Aaron that here his job is to be the transmitter of the Torah, which is different than the role of the Kohanim. The Kohanim are actors, in the literal sense. They're the ones who do the act, so they're the implementers. But Moshe's primary role here is the teacher, and that role as the transmitter of the Torah is more important. As the Gemara tells us at the end of Horius, that as much as there is a priority that's given to a Kohen, but even a Mamzer Talmid Chacham takes priority over the Kohen Gadol, because as high as you can go on the kahuna ladder, still the Talmud Torah and teacher of Torah ladder is still a more important one, and the first sees all that as conveyed in this pasuk. And then just mention the next pasuk, Vanoser, Babasar Ubalochem, Beish Tisrofu, so that which is left over of the meat and the bread, that should be burned in fire. There's a lot of technical discussions on this pasuk, and we'll just allude to, are we talking about nosar in the halachic sense, meaning that which is left over from a korban that has to be destroyed, or is it just meaning that which is technically left? Why does it say babasar instead of mibasar or milachem? That's a lot of discussion. When is one word appropriate? When is another usage appropriate? A lot of technical discussion about that. When we pesach o moed lo seitzu shivas yomim ad yom melos mei milu echem, and from the door of the o moed you shall not leave for 7 days. until the end of this process of Miluim, Kishivas Yamim Yamalei Es Yedchem. For the consecration here, the Miluim is supposed to take these 7 days. So here there is a lot to debate, a lot to try to figure out what exactly is going on. This idea of not leaving during these 7 days, so what exactly does that mean practically? What does that mean conceptually? The Ramban understands that it only refers to the time when the Avoda is happening, and that this is an Isser Ladoros, that it means that there should never have a Kohen leave when the Avoda that he's involved in is still going on. But the Rosham Shnefal Hirsch points out it's a difficult interpretation of this pasuk, because first of all, it emphasizes night and day, and so therefore, how exactly does that fit in to the Avoda? The truth is, the emphasis is in this later pasuk, Lamed Hey. Maybe we should read them all together, actually, to make this point. So let's just read all the psukim to clarify that. Psukim continue, Kasha Asa Biyom Hazeh, Siva Hashem La'asos L'chaper Aleichem, Ufesach Ohamoi Teshu Yom V'Layla, Shivas Yom V'Shmartim V'Shmeres Hashem, V'lo Samusu Kichein Suveisi. So here, this is the Pesach of Ohamoi, you should sit for 7 days, and you shall keep charge of my Mishmeres, and you shouldn't die, therefore, because this is what I have commanded. So here, in this additional pasuk, so we have a reference specifically to night and day. So what exactly is that telling us if we're talking about the Avoda is not happening at night, and also the instruction to the Bnei Aaron, so the Bnei Aaron were not doing the Avoda until day 8. So why exactly are they subject to such an instruction? If it's about not leaving during the Avoda, so then two questions, why night and day, and why them? They're not the ones doing the Avoda. The Samderech, the Snuch HaDussel Broid, the Sefer Samderech, he quotes the Ravid that even though Moshe was doing the Avoda, but they were essentially apprentices. They were helping in order to learn the trade. So therefore, they were shayach to the process. The Ibn Ezra understands this less literally. The Ibn Ezra understands that they would leave when they needed to. It doesn't mean they can't leave at all. It just means that they shouldn't take on any other involvements or go far away. And he assumes that that's the connotation of the pasuk. He says it's like the idea of Yivku b'nei Yisrael's Moshe Shloshim Yom. The Torah says that Moshe died and they cried for him for 30 days. So does it mean that they cried continuously for 30 days and they never stopped? So to hear, it meant that they in general had a presence that was constant and prioritized, but it doesn't mean that they couldn't leave at all. It's also significant to figure out what's going on here, because this idea of Shivas Yomim, so there is a notion that Chazal have, the Gemara says, and the Targum Yonasan invokes it in this pasuk, in interpreting this pasuk, that Moshe would take down the Mishkan every night, that he would set up the Mishkan in the morning and then take it down at night. So that's especially awkward if the Mishkan itself is being taken down around them. So what exactly is going on? Samderech has a comment just about this idea of the taking down and being put back up. So it sounds like 7 days, it sounds like this was happening on Shabbos too. So how do you understand that? Because if that's a part of building the Beis HaMikdash, part of building the Mishkan, building the Mikdash, so the Gemara says explicitly that Binyan Beis HaMikdash is not Docha Shabbos. It's not something that we would allow on Shabbos. So he assumes that the fact that it was taking place during Shabbos, apparently, means that this was all a part of the chinuch process. That maybe that one-time event, that's docha Shabbos. But if it was for the purposes of the binyan, so then it shouldn't be allowed. Which is interesting, because there is a lot of discussion in terms of binyan beis hamikdash that is derived from this opening and closing of the Mishkan. So it's a little bit of a complex point. Rav Hirsch comments on this idea of Kasha Asa. So who's doing are we referring to? So he notes that it's a reference to what Hashem did, and that the point of the pasuk is to convey that because Hashem commanded it, so therefore it's as if he did it. And the importance of emphasizing that this is Hashem's action is because since we are talking about sanctifying the Kohanim, so then the Kohanim have to be given this status by God, so therefore the pasuk is emphasizing that this is all ki'ilu is being done directly by God. In any event, this question of what exactly was going on there at night with them, so here for kind of a little bit of synergy, and you'll see it's two small layers of synergy, that the Rishonim have a question, and among these Rishonim is a Tosfos in Masechet Sukkah, so we'll count that as synergy, it's not our sugya yet, but a Tosfos in Sukkah and Daf Mem Gimel Amud Beis, that raises the question that how exactly could this work? So if they're there at night, so they slept there, that would be a problem, because we have a rule that Ein Yeshiva Ba'azara Ela L'Malchus Beis David Bilvad, that the only people who can sit in the Azara are those who are from the Malchus of Beis David. So how exactly were they sleeping? You know, the assumption seems to be that you can't sleep standing up, which I would dispute, but in any event, it seems to be hard to understand how exactly could they be sleeping if they're not allowed to sit in the Azara even. So in terms of going to that question, so the Pnei Yeshua in Sukkah, and here's where the synergy will go just a little bit further, the Pnei Yeshua raises the question, and it says, forget Tosfos' question. Why are they only wondering about sleep? And we can get into this argument of whether you can sleep standing up or not. Doesn't the Pasuk say, Teshvu? The Pasuk says that they're going to sit there. So that should already be a problem of Ein Yeshiva Ba'azara. So here, the Aruch HaNer has a comment, and if I said it was synergistic, so you want to guess what his explanation is? That the word Teshvu here is like another Pasuk. What? Well, yes, but what's the Pasuk? It's Sukkah Teshvu, right? That's, you're talking about the Drash on the Pasuk, right? So that when we come, we're talking about Sukkah, so we don't mean that Yeshiva B'Sukkah doesn't mean literally sitting in the Sukkah, it means dwelling in the Sukkah. So it means hanging out there. So essentially says Aruch HaNer, that's the usage here also. It doesn't have to mean that they sat there. It means that they were stopped there, that they hung around there. So then the question could be, okay, but if they're hung around there 24-7, so they're going to have to sleep. So how exactly does that fit? And that's the question of Tosfos. So the Oznayim Torah has a comment here, going back to this idea of that the Mishkan was shut down every night. He says when the Mishkan was closed, then they could leave. So that doesn't necessarily have to be a 24-7 kind of thing that didn't have any opportunity to sleep. But the Pasuk does mention Lila, so the Pasuk sounds like it was night and day. So to that he says, no, it doesn't mean all night, it means part of the night, because presumably it was open a little bit into the night hours, and it was opened up in the morning a little bit before the day starts. So there was some chelek of Lila that was involved, so that's what the Pasuk means, that they were there for all of that. It didn't necessarily mean that they had to be there for 24 hours without interruption. Rav Shamshon Fal Hirsch has an interesting comment here, where he says that this idea of Teshvu is a different meaning. He says that doesn't necessarily derive its meaning from Besukah's Teshvu, as we mentioned a minute ago, but from another pasuk in Nach. He says that what it really refers to is in the sense of, I want to take a guess on this one, it's a little harder to guess because the form of the word isn't exactly Teshvu, but it's a familiar pasuk from elsewhere in Nach. Acha she'alti me'es Hashem osa v'keish shifti b'veis Hashem. So what do we mean there? Do we mean that we should literally sit in God's house all the days of our lives? Literally sit in the Beis HaMikdash when we're not supposed to sit? Is that what the pasuk means? So presumably no. Presumably it refers to our state of mind and our attitude, that we should be thinking about God's commandments and His existence and His influence. And that mental state of shift, v'veis Hashem, kol yimei chayai, he suggests that that's what we're talking about here, that this mentality of the Mishkan was supposed to be on their minds all of that time. It's a pretty non-literal interpretation, so it's interesting if it was being invoked to Lach L'maisa nowadays. I think we'd be a little worried about that, but I guess in terms of this historical interpretation, it's a little bit more open. Now there is a interesting reality, just a comment here on this last pasuk. So, I'm sure you know that from a lifetime of giving Divrei Torah, that you could probably take a poll, and most Divrei Torah are within the first few psukim of the parsha. people don't get very far when they're thinking about the parsha. I'll say myself, this past Shabbos, parsha Vayikra, I think I spoke 3 or 4 times. Every single Dvar Torah I gave was a different citation from the first two psukim of the parsha Vayikra. Just happened to be. There's a lot to say. So it's probably statistically observable that that which is in the beginning of the parsha gets a lot more attention than that which is not. So here, this next Rashi is very interesting because it has phrases in it that you think would be commented upon, and you're more familiar with them from elsewhere. So the pasuk says, "Vayas Aaron uvanav eis kol hadvarim asher tziva Hashem biad Moshe." So Aaron and his sons, they did everything that God commanded through Moshe. So Rashi has a comment here. What is it? "Vayas Aaron uvanav lahagid shvachan." This is to say the praise of Aaron and his sons, Shlohitu yomenu small, that they did not tilt away, they did not lean in any direction, not to the right or to the left. So this is a combination of two Rashis that we're more familiar with, or two ideas that we're more familiar with than elsewhere in the Torah. One is, it's evocative of the Rashi in the beginning of Baloscha, right? That there the Pasuk talks about Aaron's lighting of the menorah, and Rashi famously quotes the idea "Lahagid shvacha shel Aaron shavoshina," that the Torah is praising Aaron that he didn't change anything, and it provokes the question: what exactly is so praiseworthy of that? That yes, he should follow God's will, but that's the basic expectation, especially of people of this caliber. So why does the Torah assume that there's a special praise that has to be conveyed there? So here there is a discussion of Sefer Ohel Moshe. It quotes an idea that it's not that we're so impressed that they didn't change anything, but that they made their actions so fitting with the mitzvah that it was as if God's will was their will. So they didn't want to change anything because they were doing exactly as they were commanded from an internal place. Rav Gifter has a comment over here that he says it means that they did the mitzvah, they did this action with the same simcha as if they heard it from God directly. That was the point, because the pasuk ends off that as God commanded beyond Moshe, so he understands that that's the emphasis. That just like if God had talked to them directly, they would have great simcha in doing what he said. So too, even though it came through the hands of Moshe, so they had the same simcha. Rav Schwab has a comment in a completely different vein, which connects this to what we were talking about a minute or two ago, and gives a whole different sense to it, that he understands that the Mishkan was taken down at night, that's what happened, and yet they stayed there, so it's different from some of the interpretations that we've seen, and that was difficult, because they had to stay in the exact place of the Pesach Ol Moed. And the Pesach Ol Moed, well, the Ol Moed wasn't actually there anymore, it was taken down. So you can imagine how hard that is to stay in the exact place without having any physical marker of where to be. So he says that's what they were talking about, that they didn't tilt not to the right or the left. That's the very impressive act of commitment that the Pesach is conveying. Okay, of course you see Yom Minusmol. It's interesting because that should remind you of another pasuk that we've spoken about this year, talking about the idea of lo saser. The Torah tells us that we're not supposed to deviate from what the Chazal tell us, or how the Rambam understands it, even including gzeros. So we shouldn't deviate not to the right or to the left. And it's always an issue to figure out exactly what that means. Rashi quotes the idea from the Medrash that even if they tell you left is right or right is left, you still should listen to them. Others have different interpretations. It's very not clear, because nowadays we use left and right to mean certain political affiliations or religious affiliations, but that's not the way the Torah or Chazal talk, because that was something that goes back to the French Parliament. It's much more recent. So what exactly means here is not clear. In the Sefer Paradis Yosef, he quotes a notion that in the context of Parshas Shoftim by Chazal, where it says Yad Minusmol, so there really means Mitzvah Saseh and Mitzvah Losaseh. Why exactly it should mean that, I'm not sure. Why that language connotes one way or another. It's like you have a dial, go up and down, so you take away a little bit, you add a little bit. I'm not sure exactly where the imagery comes from. But, so, just like Chazal, when they make Gezeiros, it's similar to Rambam, that's what it's talking about, that sometimes they add on a little bit, sometimes they take away a little bit, and either way, you have to listen. You're not allowed to deviate. So here, it must mean that they're being praised for not deviating from what was commanded to them, whether that would mean doing a little bit less or doing more. Maybe they would think that they should make their own safeguards, their own extra practices here, and they're being credited for not doing that. Okay, so maybe we'll say just a little bit about the Shabbos HaGadol. So just mention, first of all, some of the possibilities about why Shabbos HaGadol is called Shabbos HaGadol, the Great Shabbos. Of course, we hope that you'll always have a great Shabbos, but why is this Shabbos identified as particularly great? So there are a number of theories and maybe reasons why you could also connect it to Parshas Tzav, we'll see, time permitting. Very often is the case that it falls out on Parshas Tzav. Rabbi Simon Shlita has in the Sefer Mebarach has a discussion about this, how to connect Parshas Tzav and Shabbos HaGadol, so one way or another. So where does this word come from, Shabbos HaGadol? So one point to be aware of is that there is often, usually when you have these extra names that are given to a Shabbos, so it's usually associated with the Haftorah, and that could be true here as well. So for example, the Shabbos in between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which we call Shabbos Teshuva, so it sounds right, it's the Aseres Yemei Teshuva, but it's not Shabbos Teshuva, it's Shabbos Shuva, because the Haftorah begins with the word Shuva. So that's where the name comes from for the special nickname Shabbos. So to here, we read from Malachi, and we read the idea of Hinei Anochi Shaleach Lachem Es Le'anav L'fnei Bo Yom HaGadol L'Hanora. So that's the interpretation that Abidram has, that because the Haftorah is inclusive of that phrase, so just like Shabbos Shuva, Shabbos Chazon, Shabbos Nachmu, the special Shabbos names are very often inspired by the Haftorah, so too Shabbos HaGadol as well. But there are other ideas. One, the perhaps the most well-known idea, is that the Medrash focuses on the theme of the Korban Pesach, which is an understandable connection here, and that there was a miracle that happened. So, what was the miracle exactly? So, the Medrash Rabbah quotes a miracle that the Mitzrim were told by the Jews who were setting aside the Korban Pesach that this is an offering to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's also going to kill the firstborn Egyptians. So those firstborn, they heard about this, they were not happy, and they went to Paro, and they said, let's let the Jews go. But they were told no. So these firstborn, they then set up to fight a war against them, and a lot of Egyptians were killed, and that perhaps is a reference to some great miraculous event that happened here. But maybe more well known than that is the idea that there was another nace, and this one is kind of one you could figure out just from the facts here, that the lamb that they're setting aside for Korban Pesach, so the lamb was the god of the Egyptians. So when the Egyptians saw that the Jews are setting aside their god in order to sacrifice, so you can imagine that they weren't very happy. So despite the fact that they were presumably infuriated by this idea, that they were watching their god being sacrificed, they were unable to do anything about it, they couldn't object, they couldn't lift a finger, they couldn't do anything to interfere, and that's the great miracle, that's the Nes Gadol that gives this Shabbos its name. Now, the Pri Chodesh is a different understanding. He says that this is the day that the Jews were given the opportunity to do their first mitzvah, their first mitzvah of setting aside the Korban Pesach. Then maybe you'll ask, well, isn't the first mitzvah famously a Chodesh Hazeh Lachem? So yes, that's the first mitzvah that's instructed, but that wasn't something they could do at that time. So it's not the first mitzvah they were actually doing. but setting aside the Korban Pesach, that's the first mitzvah they're actually doing. So essentially, that's like their bar mitzvah Shabbos, the first time they're doing mitzvahs, the first time they became gedolim, they became adults, obligated mitzvahs. So therefore, perhaps that should be the name for the Shabbos. And Chassam Sofer writes that the idea is that this is the time when the Jews came back to God fully. So they did tshuva, and God is called the Gadol. So therefore, they took on this godless, and that's why the Shabbos is named after it. The Shiboli Haleket has a different understanding, which maybe we could relate to a little bit more directly, and that is that there is a practice, as we know, that the rabbi gives a long drasha on Shabbos HaGadol. It used to be once upon a time that not only was a drasha long, but once upon a time the rabbi only gave a drasha twice a year on Shabbos Shuvah and Shabbos HaGadol. So what happens when the rabbi speaks on Shabbos? So I'd like to say it means it's a big event, and therefore it should be called Shabbos HaGadol, but what they actually bring is that feels long. So therefore, it's called the Shabbos HaGadol, which is similar to an idea we find by Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is called the Tzomer Rabbah, the big fast, because it feels long. It's very hard to get through. So to Shabbos HaGadol represents that idea. But maybe we'll just mention one more idea, Piderach HaDrush, to connect it to Parshas Tzav. It's different than what I was saying before about Rabbi Sam. If you look at his Sefer, he focuses on this idea of the Korban Pesach, and the various hints in the parsha about Korban Shlomim and the like that could connect to Korban Pesach. But maybe we'll derive another idea from Parshas Tzav that we spoke a little bit when we talked about Chinuch, I think, and maybe around that time, we talked a little bit about the concept of Chatzi Shir, right? The idea that there is a prohibition of eating forbidden foods, let's say, even when something is not a full amount. So let's say, to make it Yonah Dioma, so when it comes to Pesach, so we're not allowed to eat a kezias of chametz. If we have a kezias of chametz, we're chayiv karis. But you shouldn't come to the conclusion that since you're chayiv karis for a kezias, that you are therefore permitted to have a little crumb. If it's less than a kezias, so it's okay, it's mutter. So no, we discussed that the Gemara says not that way. The Gemara says that there's a prohibition of Chatzishir Asur min HaTorah. So the question is, what's the source for that prohibition? So the Gemara gives two possible sources. Either as a pasuk of Kol Chelev, which is in this week's Parsha, that's where it comes in, that it's a pasuk in Parsha Tzav, that suggests that we have a prohibition of Chelev. So then apparently the interpretation of the pasuk is that it's not only that once the chelev reaches a certain threshold, then it becomes prohibited. But kol chelev, all of the chelev is prohibited. So too any part of the substance is prohibited. And the other possibility is the pasuk of chazi litzrufe, the pasuk that we discussed earlier in the year, that since this small quantity, you combine it with more of a quantity, and you're going to have a full-blown prohibition, so too this smaller amount is also prohibited. So some of the Rishonim say that the Svara and the Pasuk, they work together to tell you this din. So the question is, what does this Svara mean? This idea of Chazlitz Drupa. Again, if you recall, we spoke about this. And there's two ways to understand it. That either it's like a Gezeira Daraisa, as we've talked about in other contexts, that really less than a shear should be mutter. But we call this, I think, the potato chip svara, that you can't have just one. If you're going to start to have a little bit, you're going to end up continuing. And the fear is, if you have less than a shear, you're starting off with that, but ultimately you're going to end up having a full shear. So therefore, we should not allow you to have even a little bit. While the other idea is that the svara is not a siag, it's not that we're afraid of what's going to happen, but that already we see in the svara that what you're doing is bad. Because if we have such a concept that the Torah tells you you're not allowed to eat this, and if you eat a certain amount, you're going to be chayiv misa, chayiv kares, chayiv malchus, whatever it is, so then that seems to be telling to you that this is a bad thing. You should not eat it. And the fact that you get punished at a certain threshold, okay, that's just because it has to be something that's significant. But it, apparently what the message is of the punishment is that this is a bad thing. So we can figure out on our own that we should not eat even a little bit because it's bad. Maybe that's what the Svar of Chazlitt's true fame is. So there is a question that the Achronim ask, and again, this is nearly the Yom topic. So, all right, so we know that when it comes to Chametz on Pesach, if we have even a little bit of Chametz on Pesach, it's not necessarily a Chiyuv Karis, but it's prohibited. What about the opposite question? Let's say it's Pesach night, and you have only a little bit of matzah. You have less than a kezias of matzah. Without getting into the discussion that maybe a kezias is significantly smaller than people think it is, but okay, let's assume that however small the kezias is, you have less than the kezias of matzah. It's a question that's been asked throughout the generations because it certainly can come up. So, of course, if you have a very small amount for a lot of people. So, you have only a little bit of matzah. So, is there a concept of chatzi shir by mitzvot? Do we say the chatzi shir is only about averos? That it means that you should not eat less than a kezias of prohibited food? Or does it mean, even for mitzvot, that even though the chiyuv is to eat a kezias of matzah, but if you have a half a kezias, it's still kedai? Follow the concept, the idea of the chatzi shir by mitzvot, that even less than a shir is still a good act. So it seems, and this is something Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg points out in a sefer for Shirim, that it seems like it should be totally on the two ways to understand the nature of Chazalit's Trufe. Right? That if the idea is it's a siag, that we're concerned you're going to come to finish the whole thing, so then that logic doesn't really flip to mitzvos. That really only makes sense by averos. But if we're saying that the fact that there's a punishment when you cross a certain threshold, that shows you that this is bad, so that does theoretically fit. We could say the opposite also, that if there's a mitzvah that you accomplish by eating a kezias of matzah, so then that means that eating matzah is a good thing. And we can figure out that even if we don't have a whole kezias of matzah, to have a little bit is also a good thing. So it seems like that's a reasonable assumption to depend it on this issue, that if it's about what this shear reflects on the whole concept, so then that works both by positive mitzvos and negative mitzvos. That it's bad to have even a little bit if it's an avera, and it's good to have even a little bit if it's a mitzvah. But we said a second ago that if it's about a siag, if it's about what we're afraid is going to happen next, so that kind of thinking only works for averas and not for mitzvos. But is that really true? Maybe we could say no. Maybe we could say that by mitzvos as well, so we know that people do continue with inertia, that when somebody starts off on a certain path, so they do continue on that path usually. So therefore, the same logic of a gzeira does have a place in mitzvah discussion. That's just like when it comes to avera, so we're worried that if you start down a certain path, there's a good likelihood that you will continue on that path. So the same logic could make an argument that when it comes to mitzvahs also, even if you're going to do a mitzvah only a little bit, even if it's not really what would qualify as enough, but it's still something, because that could set a pattern for you that you will continue to follow, and maybe you will ultimately do these mitzvahs. So perhaps you could say the notion of Shabbos HaGadol, the idea of Godless being our aspiration, that we focus on these first mitzvahs that we did, and we focus on our becoming Gedolim, becoming people of stature, being people of full majority obligated mitzvahs, and our hope is that that will take us to greater and greater heights, and that we can aspire to Godless through these initial small actions. Did I get a question?
Yeah, the point with the matzah then, well, I thought the whole idea is that if you don't have the matzah with you, so you only have chatzi shir available, so
right,
you would continue on.
And you can say the same thing by... You can say the same thing by the Aveir, which is also a discussion, okay. Which is a major discussion in post. If you don't have the rest of the shir, should we say it's mutter? So to that extent, it's a valid point. But to whatever extent, we don't divide between these things, we don't distinguish. So you could say that still, all right, whatever you have now is going to get you off to a good start. And even if right now you may not necessarily have the possibility of accomplishing the whole mitzvah, but starting down on that path, there's always going to be something which is going to point you in the right direction, and therefore maybe that's still valuable. So with all that, I hope that we do all have a sincerely great Shabbos. But before we still have to daven mincha, so let's just do that, and then I will see you. we've got to roll in on Sunday. Who wants it out for us? Zach, we're poised.
Okay, Ashri Osher, we